What Elie Wiesel, Nobel laureate, activist, author, and Holocaust survivor, wanted to teach the world about memory.
The real core question for him was, how do you create witnesses? How do you create morally activated people, people who are committed to values and will be agents of goodness in the world, in a world where there are people who are filled with hate, who commit hate crimes and atrocities, but there are a far larger number of people who are indifferent and who are silent and who are spectators, who allow things to happen. So how do you do that? And for him, the core response to that question lies with memory.
That's Ariel Berger, Wiesel's former teaching assistant and author of the new book, Witness, Lessons from Elie Wiesel's Classroom. And later in the show, we re-air our 2016 interview with Ani Tussman about her novel based on the life of the 18th century Jewish mystic, the Baal Shem Tov. It's called The Tremble of Love. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Elie Wiesel was a towering presence on the world stage, a Nobel laureate, activist, advisor to world leaders, and the author of more than 40 books. But when asked, Wiesel always said, "I'm a teacher first." He taught at Boston University for nearly 40 years, and helping him for some of that time was his protege, teaching assistant, and friend Ariel Berger. In his book, Witness, Lessons from Elie Wiesel's Classroom, Berger shows how Wiesel challenged his students to explore moral complexity and resist the dangerous lure of absolutes. In recounting moments between Wiesel and his students, the book creates a kind of primer on educating against indifference, on the urgency of memory and individual responsibility, and on the role of literature and art in making the world a more compassionate place. Ariel Berger is a writer, artist, teacher, and rabbi whose work combines spirituality, creativity, and strategies for social change. Well, Ariel Berger, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
Now, in this book, Witness, Lessons from Elie Wiesel's Classroom, you talk about first meeting Elie Wiesel when you were just a teenager, and it made a big impression on you. Tell us about that.
Yes. I had read Night, his first work, his story of surviving the Holocaust, and I met him after a lecture that he gave in New York to about 1,000 people, and there was a small reception room. I was brought there by my stepfather, who knew Professor Wiesel, and I remember that Elie Wiesel, who had just given a lecture to 1,000 people, held his hand out to me and said his name as if I had never heard of him before, didn't know who he was. And I was really struck by that sense of modesty, humility, and presence. And I was very shy, so I think I just said hi or something and didn't really get into a conversation, but I established a connection with him over the next years when I would visit with him and bring him my questions.
Yeah, and tell us just a little bit about your own religious upbringing. You grew up in a fairly observant household.
I grew up in a mixed and interesting set of households. My parents weren't together from the time I was 8 years old. So their homes were different in terms of their religious expressions and observances. And I was also sent to a very religious school. So during the day, I was taught by Hasidic teachers. We studied traditional Jewish religious texts like the Talmud in great depth. And then I would come home and watch TV and live a normal American Jewish life. But because my parents' observance levels were different, I grew up with a very keen sense of difference and eventually of pluralism, that there are different ways of expressing deep religious feeling, and they're not all identical, and they're all legitimate. So that was the positive side. The challenge was, of course, how to fit all these pieces of myself and my life together.
And Elie Wiesel was a great influence in helping you to do that.
Very much so. He grew up in that deeply religious environment that existed before World War II in many Eastern European Jewish communities. And on his mother's side, was very connected to the Hasidic tradition, which is a more mystical side of Judaism. And at the same time, he was so deeply rooted in the modern world, and as an activist and a confidant of presidents and prime ministers, and of course as an author. So I, pretty early on in my late teens, I had a sense that this is somebody who can really speak to all of those elements and who lives it in such an integrated and graceful way that I really wanted to learn from.
Now, as you mentioned before, you read Night when you were like 13, and a lot of our listeners, I'm sure, have read it or certainly have heard about it, but just kind of recap for us a little bit about Elie Wiesel's early history. You know, you just talked about his upbringing in Eastern Europe. First, tell us a little bit about the Hasidic tradition that he grew up in, and then just briefly tell us about his experience of the Holocaust.
Well, so going way back first, the Hasidic tradition started in the late 1700s as a kind of mystical revivalist movement, somewhat similar to the Shaker or Quaker movements in other parts of the world and in Christian tradition. But it was really a revolutionary movement that emphasized personal expression and the idea that there are many, many ways to develop an intimate relationship with God. And that spread like wildfire throughout Eastern Europe from around 1772 and on. And by the time Elie Wiesel was born in 1928, there were Hasidic communities in every major center and many small villages as well that were populated by Jews. And so his mother was a follower, his maternal grandfather was a close follower of one of those masters, Hasidic masters in the area where he lived, which was sometimes Hungary, sometimes Romania, sometimes Transylvania, depending on how the borders were drawn, and it changed often. But he was born in a town called Sziget and really lived a life of piety and fervor. And he described his childhood as being filled with prayer and traditional study and spiritual practices and the yearning to bring the Messiah to the world. That was really a big part of his young life. He was a very serious, studious boy, and he studied mysticism as a teenager and really was deeply involved in religious life. It was the center for him. He said once that he knew the streets of Jerusalem from the sacred literature better than he knew the streets of his own town. And so he really lived in that world that kind of transcends time and place. And then that, of course, came to a crashing halt in 1944 when the Nazis invaded Hungary, and the family lost their citizenship first and then were herded into a ghetto and then eventually were deported. And he tells the story in Night, of course, of what happened after that.
Tell us about what he said about the role of memory, because Night is, of course, about terrible things that are happening, that happened to him. His father was killed, his family was killed. And I think many of us have seen the photo of Elie Wiesel in Buchenwald as a teenager, just starved practically to, you know, he's beyond gaunt. But he said, "I'm turning memories into a blessing." So talk about how he saw the role of memory in his work.
Yeah, that's an important quote. And he spoke about this in class several times, that the survivors of the Holocaust had a major challenge, which is, what will we do with our memories? And the memories were of such horrific things and such transcendently terrible things, things that are hard to imagine, even for those who went through it, and how much more so for those who didn't, that it would be understandable for someone to come out of that experience with a sense of rage and darkness and despondency, especially once they learned that the world, the Western powers, knew what was happening and didn't do enough to stop it. So one could be forgiven for giving up on humanity, and for that matter, giving up on a God who was silent during the Holocaust. But Elie Wiesel and many survivors chose life instead, and they chose to share their stories when they did as a way of inspiring greater sensitivity and a sense of responsibility for other human beings. As he said many times, because of what I experienced, I wanted to make sure that no one else anywhere would have to experience anything like it. So he took his story, and that's what he means, I think, by making it into a blessing, was make it a source of sensitivity, of courage, of urgency to create a world where such a thing could never happen again. And that was what he taught his students.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Ariel Berger about his book, Witness, Lessons from Elie Wiesel's Classroom. We're talking about Elie Wiesel's words as you've written about them in this book, Witness. So talking about witness, he said something very interesting. He said, listening to witnesses makes one a witness. So talk about that connection of memory to witness, to how the circle of witnesses expands.
Well, first, what's the opposite of a witness? Elie Wiesel wrote once that the opposite of a witness is a spectator. And so when he talked about creating witnesses, which he hoped his students would be, he hoped his readers would be, he hoped that really anyone who cares about goodness would be, is somebody who stands up against injustice, who is not indifferent, because indifference is the enemy, and it was what allowed the Holocaust to happen. The indifference of the world allows terrible things like genocide to happen. And so the real core question for him was, how do you create witnesses? How do you create morally activated people, ethically sensitive people, people who are committed to values and will be agents of goodness in the world, in a world where there are people who are filled with hate, who commit hate crimes and atrocities, but there are a far larger number of people who are indifferent and who are silent and who are spectators, who allow things to happen. So how do you do that? And for him, the core response to that question lies with memory. And memory for him meant not only the transmission of information, of stories that have happened in the past, but really a leap of empathy and imagination, being able to really connect deeply and emotionally to someone else's experience and to hear someone else's story, such that when you leave that encounter, you are now somehow a vehicle for that story. You carry that story with you. And so when you encounter the story of a Holocaust survivor, and now you're walking in the world and you're carrying that story, it's in you somewhere, in your heart, in your mind, in your bones, if you've really incorporated it deeply. And now you encounter another instance of oppression or mass murder or genocide, or at a smaller scale, someone who needs your help. You will respond differently than you would have before encountering that story. And so listening to a witness makes you a witness means that memory is transmittable. Not only the information and the facts and figures, which we are very important, we need to know what happened, we need to remember the details of what happened, but also the emotional experience, the psychological transformation that comes with that. That's possible, and it happens through encounter, it happens through listening deeply to other people's stories, and it happens through reading other people's testimonies in literature, in diaries, in works of great philosophy, people who wrestled with historical moments that were very challenging and developed responses to those moments from which we can learn. And that's why really Elie Wiesel, as a tremendous act of hope, became a teacher, because he believed that this is possible. It's possible to transmit memory to the next generations and make his experiences into a source of meaning, and as you said before, a source of blessing.
Yeah, and when you say transforming those experiences, I mean, you quote him, maybe it's a quote from Knight. He says, "Never shall I forget the silence that deprived me for all eternity of the desire to live." And this is in response to, I think, almost on his first night in Auschwitz, he witnessed the hanging of a young child and, of course, witnessed the murder of many young children. Talk about despair. You know, he said at one point that despair and hope are two sides of the same coin. I guess I have a hard time understanding that. So can you kind of unpack this hope, despair conundrum for us?
Yeah, that quote is from Knight. It's one of the most powerful and famous moments from that book. And it's almost biblical in its tone and its language, its use of language. That word never is repeated, I think, 8 times. 7 times is a very biblical number. The 8th time in biblical numerology is always going beyond the natural order of things, transcending an experience. And that scene of the hanging of a child is really, it's biblical in its power and its the horrific nature of the moment. And it happened. And so I think Elie Wiesel's experience of despair was real. And he talked about it in Night and elsewhere and in the classroom. But as a moral choice, he rejected it because despair leads to more evil and more suffering. Whereas choosing hope means that you may invest your time, your energy, your presence in trying to make the world better. And who knows what the outcome will be, but maybe something good will come out of that. And so Elie Wiesel himself did that. He was relentless and tireless in his efforts to prevent genocide, to bring attention to oppressed people around the world, to celebrate great wisdom from human traditions, to connect the particularity of his Jewish heritage with universal concerns and questions. He did that because he had hope. He taught students because he had hope, and he didn't give in to despair. But he explored despair often in his teaching. In fact, one of his classes that he taught when I was his teaching assistant at Boston University was called Faith and Despair. And it was a full semester of examining great texts, novels and plays and philosophical works about despair and about hope. And ultimately, he believed that hope is a choice, that we're, he quoted Camus, who said that when there is no hope, we must create it. But it would be disingenuous to say that he didn't experience despair or that we don't experience despair sometimes. And I think one of the distinctions that's important to remember and that's been helpful to me is that you can feel an emotional state of despair. You can feel a feeling of despair, and that's very different than the moral choice of despair, which is sort of an eternal, permanent giving up, throwing up your hands and saying there's no purpose in fighting for anything. And so I think the emotional sense of feeling despair is legitimate. And when we encounter the suffering in the world, it's a natural response to have moments like that. But to give up entirely, to make the ethical or existential move toward despair and accept despair as a solution, as an answer, as the final answer, is not something that he accepted. And he explored this a lot in his writing, in various books, including The Accident, which is an early novel exploring the theme of despair. But really, he rejected it in favor of celebration and celebration of learning, and of friendship and connection to other people and working to make the world better in whatever way we can.
In that poem in Night, he said he was deprived for all eternity of the desire to live, but it sounds like that's something that he regained.
Well, you know, I've often wondered about that line. It struck me also because I knew him as somebody with incredible joie de vivre and curiosity and humor, and also gravitas and depth and intensity, but certainly not as someone who is depressed or angry, just the opposite. I mean, this is someone who, anyone who knew him reported that he was so lovely to be with and was so inspiring and uplifting. And he had an almost childlike sense of curiosity and wonder in the classroom. And that was very contagious. So I thought about that line also, and I think there's 2 possibilities here, and I don't know the answer. One is that he recovered from that experience. And the other is that the use of the word forever is real, and that on some level, he lost something that could never be regained. And his favorite phrase in life in general was the phrase, and yet. He loved paradox. So, and paradoxically somehow, even with that feeling of despair and everything he encountered in what he called the kingdom of night, he also had a sense of love of life. And those 2 things came together. And it's possible to hold those two things, even though they seem completely irreconcilable. But somehow he managed to hold those two things together.
Another thing you explore that is, I think, very close to this, Ariel Berger, that you explore in this book, Witness, Lessons from Elie Wiesel's Classroom, is how he related to the question of faith and doubt, which is also something that you wrestled with. He said at one point that it would have been easier for him if he had not had faith. I mean, we're talking about religious faith here. So tell us about his view of faith and doubt.
Yeah. So as I said before, he grew up in a deeply religious environment, and he himself was a very religious, fervently religious young boy. And so I think he felt a sense of personal betrayal that's hard to describe when he realized that, and he writes about this in Night as well, when he realized that this is happening, this is real, and God is letting it happen. God is silent here. And so it would have been easier to not believe in a just and kind God, an infinitely powerful God. It would have been easier if he had been an atheist to say, well, of course, there's no God and there's plenty of room for terrible things to happen. And we only have to deal with the human question, not the question about God. But he didn't have that out. He believed in God very deeply. And so he spent years after the Holocaust developing an approach to theology and faith, which really centered on wrestling with the question, not resolving it. He rejected resolutions to that question. He said, if anybody comes and explains why God was silent during the Holocaust, I would reject their answer. It doesn't matter how good the answer is. It's not a question that can be answered. And he developed what he called a wounded faith, which means expressing your protest and your quarrel with God as an expression of faith. And this is drawing on an old Jewish tradition of arguing with God as an expression of religious faith. It starts with Abraham in the Bible, who argues with God on behalf of the evil city of Sodom. And this is presented to us as readers of the Bible as a deeply religious impulse to argue with God, to demand that God live up to God's own ethical standards that God is seeming to teach us, and calling God out on the perceived hypocrisy of expecting us to behave well and to not murder when God is allowing terrible things to happen. In the Jewish tradition, that's something that you're allowed to do. And Elie Wiesel wrote a book called The Trial of God, which is based on something he saw in Auschwitz. He saw three old rabbis organize a court case where they put God on trial. And they accused God of allowing these terrible things to happen to the Jewish people during the Holocaust. And they brought witnesses for the prosecution and witnesses for the defense. And in the end, they found God guilty. And after they found God guilty, they said, okay, the court case is over. Now it's time to go pray the evening prayer. And so you see this stunning paradoxical example of faith and faithfulness and reverence with a radical form of protest, with what the Hasidim would call holy chutzpah, in the sense that you can really take God to task. And that's what Elie Wiesel did in much of his writing. And he once said in class, when I leave the world and I go up to heaven, I'm going to have one question for God. The question is, why?
Another idea that I found very powerful in this book, Witness, was the idea of madness and the witness, that the witness to evil is regarded as mad. But it's more than that. Talk about that and tell us, by way of that, the story of the beetle. I forget his name. This was the man who kind of took care of the synagogue, making sure everything was clean and ready for prayer, who had been deported and then actually came back, lived to tell the tale of the deportations. Now, of course, Hungary was quite late in the Jews of Hungary being taken over and deported. It was 1944. It was, you know, started in 1940, you know, even earlier, maybe in Germany, in 1942 and other places. So tell us about that story and Madness and the Witness.
Yeah, very important theme for Elie Wiesel. He was really preoccupied with this theme in several ways. The first is what you mentioned, which is also in Night, and Moshe the Beetle is the one who, in the beginning of the story, has returned from a deportation because he didn't have the right citizenship papers, if I remember correctly. And he comes back and he tells the Jews of Sighet, of Elie Wiesel's town, what he has seen, and nobody believes him. Because it's unthinkable that thousands of Jews are being shot in an operation, that they have to dig their own graves and they're shot. No one can believe. It's like something out of a terrible fairy tale. And so the true witness, the person who's reporting on what's happening, and in fact could bring some degree of salvation to people, because if they believe him, maybe they'll run away or take advantage of opportunities to hide in the woods, which Elie Wiesel's family had. He's not believed. And so that's one way in which Elie Wiesel became preoccupied with the theme of madness. But he also juxtaposed two kinds of madness. The first is the moral madness of a world that descends into fascism or other forms of terror and oppression. And really, that's a world of madness. The world of the Holocaust is a world of madness. A concentration camp was a place where the rules of morality and humanity were suspended. And there's a certain kind of demonic element to it. And it seems to be really mad. And the solution to that, the response to that, that Elie Wiesel found, is what he called mystical madness, which is the madness of hope, the madness of believing that a better world is possible. A kind of messianic madness, a madness that causes you, in spite of all the evidence of your senses and everything you might see or read about, to still believe that the world can get better and that we can fight back against the moral madness which destroys the world. And he brought this full circle because the character of Moshe in Night, the character of the witness who sees what's happening, names it, when it's sort of unpopular to do so and won't be believed, the person won't be believed, that move, that act of naming evil is the beginning of the response to evil. Because Elie Wiesel taught, what's worse than evil? Evil wearing a mask. So the first step is to name it and pull off the mask so that we can respond to it in an appropriate way. And that's the role of the witness, and the witness is often perceived as a madman. And if choosing madness by the world standards is the only way that you can do something to make the world better, if people are going to think you're crazy because you have a dream of making the world better because you're doing something that's unpopular or countercultural or nonconformist, then by all means, choose that kind of mystical madness to make the world better.
Well, I think that's a great place to end. Ariel Berger, your book is Witness, Lessons from Elie Wiesel's Classroom. And I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. This has been a really fascinating conversation.
Thank you very much.
Despite his unquestionable moral force, there have been those who have pointed out that Elie Wiesel's record of compassion faltered when it came to justice for the Palestinian people. He was on record supporting Israeli settlements that have taken over Palestinian land in the occupied territories, and also in failing to publicly criticize Israel's human rights violations. I asked Ariel Berger about this in our interview. Go to writersvoice.net to hear that part of our conversation. You can also read a message to me from Berger about Wiesel's work on behalf of victims of other genocides and mass murders since the Holocaust, above all in Darfur. Next up in this Hanukkah special, we re-air an extended excerpt from our interview with Ani Tusman about her novel, The Tremble of Love. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Hanukkah began on December 2nd this year and ends on December 10th. 2 years ago, around Hanukkah, we spoke with Ani Tuzman about her novel, The Tremble of Love, based on the life of the 18th century Jewish mystic, the Baal Shem Tov. We air a long excerpt from that interview today. The 18th century Jewish spiritual master, Rabbi Yisrael ben Eliezer, is a legendary figure in Jewish history. Best known as the Baal Shem Tov, or the Good Master of the Name, he preached the practice of joy and compassion as the surest way to celebrate God. But the historical record about the Baal Shem Tov is skimpy. He didn't write his teachings down. Instead, he spread his gospel in person to the Jewish communities of the Polish-Lithuanian region. He healed the sick using herbs and amulets, but he also healed minds and souls with his message of love. My guest, Ani Tuzman, takes inspiration from the legend of the Baal Shem Tov to create her richly realized novel, The Tremble of Love. She follows Yisrael's life from his orphaned childhood, steeped in the deepest poverty, to the end of his life as an esteemed spiritual leader. The novel shows how this remarkable figure transcended the prejudices of his time to honor women equally with men and Christians as well as Jews. The book contains much contemporary resonance with the dark times we face, as the Baal Shem Tov confronts false prophets with his message of the power of love. Well, Ani Tuzman, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca. I'm so glad to be here.
So this book, The Tremble of Love, is a novel inspired by the legendary spiritual master, Rabbi Yisrael ben Eliezer. He was known as the Baal Shem Tov. Who was he, and why was he called the Baal Shem Tov?
He was started out as a youth that people thought was very strange, unable to read, to learn to read, unable to look people in the eyes when they communicated with him. He was an orphan. And so the prognosis, they didn't use that word, but certainly was not greatness in this being. But as time evolved, and it is all swathed in legend, as the preface of the book says, he had many teachers, was guided to teachers on his path. Among them, no one is sure. And so in the book, I've written based on the legends and also my own intuitions. And there were herbalists, there were Kabbalists, there were rabbis. And above all, he found his greatest teachers to be everyday people, the tradespeople in the marketplace, the people who didn't know how to read and write. He called those his greatest teachers. And so he learned about the human heart, about human suffering, about kindness. And it's not clear, you know, nowadays there, and it's for some time, there have been ordinations, official ordinations of Rabbi Smicha is the name. And it's not clear when he had official Smicha. In the book, I describe it as really the people starting to call him Rabbi. And so his ordination came from the very people in the marketplace, in the roads, on the farms, on the land. He was a healer and did use herbs. He did also use so the word Baal Shem, now we're coming to that.
But before we get further into this, first tell us, when did he live and where did he live?
He lived in the 18th century. He was born just before the turn of the century, in 1698, in what was called the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, now is the Ukraine.
Okay, so he lived there. What was that society like for Jews at that time?
There were various classes of Jews. And of course, there was anti-Semitism, and there was a place for Jews in the society. Jews had certain roles they played and certain roles they weren't allowed to play. There were Jews that were tradespeople. There were Jews could not own land, but they were often leaseholders. They often served, one of the things that got them in trouble was they often served as tax collectors for the nobility. So, and also the nobility that owned taverns, the Jews ran the taverns, and the Jews often collected the taxes. These were roles that they played. And there were extreme paupers. There were those that did trade and textile trade or gems from the Ottoman Empire. So there were many social classes, and there were limits on the rights and the roles of Jews. The Jews had their own governing councils in the towns and villages. They were under Polish law, of course, but they also had, there was Jewish law, and they could ordain, they could make determinations. There were Jewish courts.
So before we go too much further about the Baal Shem Tov, you've talked about him being somebody who was a peculiar person as a boy. But I think our listeners would like to know, how did you get interested in the story? Because I read somewhere that you actually experienced an inner call to write about the Baal Shem Tov, who was a spiritual master.
I did. I had heard of the Baal Shem Tov all my life. My parents survived the Holocaust, and so Eastern Europe and what happened to the legacy of Judaism and the Jewish people there was a topic that was always in the foreground of my mind. So, and at some point in my own journey, I studied in a yeshiva with rabbis, and I had heard of the Baal Shem Tov for years. And I had a book on my shelf. I believe it was the only book in English at the time, for many years. And it was a translation of legends about the Baal Shem Tov. And I would periodically pick it up and was so taken. The two primary things that took me were his joy and his, what I began to call his equal vision, the way he regarded all people, women, children, the poor, people who were not Jewish, as worthy and equal. So that he was there always. And then I did experience an inner call. I had just finished another book, and I was meditating, and I experienced, however that works, wherever that comes from deep within, I experienced a call to write a book about him and his teachings. And I saw right away, I'm not a scholar, and I apprehended that it was to be a novel. And I said yes immediately inside. And then I said, but you can do much better than me. There are famous Jewish writers. And I heard some answers as to why me. And one of them was, you said yes. And many years later, I remembered something that's in the Torah. And the words are na'aseh v'nishma. They're Hebrew. And they mean roughly, we'll do it and then you explain. So yes, and then you explain. And I realized that moment was a na'aseh v'nishma moment. I said, oh my God, yes, of course. And then I said, but, but now the promise is fulfilled.
That's wonderful. So the Baal Shem Tov, first of all, what does the name mean?
That's what I was just coming to before. So Baal Shem is literally a master of the name. The plural in Hebrew is Baalei Shem. So there were many. This was a common practice. There were individuals, primarily men. Men are all that were written about. I believe there were women doing this as well. And they used amulets with, they used herbs and other things as well. But Baal Shem, the word Shem, name, it's referring to the divine name. And so they used amulets to heal. And they would place these on parts of the body. They would repeat the divine name. There was always usually, as far as my research reveals, there was a physical component, an amulet, often written on parchment, but also the recitation of the names. And so this is one of the things Yisrael did. He was a Baal Shem. He practiced healing using the name. Over time, he became known as the Baal Shem Tov. The word Tov means good. So there are two ways this has been translated. One is the good master of the name, and the other is the master of the good name. But the distinction was he's the only one that was called the Baal Shem Tov. And this was a reflection of that there was something about this Baal Shem that was different than the others, because there were hundreds of them throughout Eastern Europe and perhaps other parts of Europe that practiced and that did healing, and he was distinguished from those.
And he seems like an almost Christ-like figure in your book, The Tremble of Love, with a message that is just completely grounded in love. I kept on thinking that it, you know, the way he preaches, the way he, as you said, he has this idea that everyone is worthy. He treats everybody equally. Did you make that connection as well?
Of course. Of course. Of course I did.
So what's your take on that?
Well, you know, I was thinking about that earlier. I was having a conversation with someone about the current political situation, and I was later on reflecting about fear and love. And love, one primary, if not the primary message, as it were, there's much in the book, of course, but is the power of love. This is not something sappy. This is not a nice word. This is a force. This is a power. And this is a power that can transform. There's one quote. Someone is talking to the Baal Shem Tov, and he says, he is asking, and the Baal Shem Tov, he says, "I'm counseling you to stand rooted in the truth you wish to protect, rather than bent over by fear. I urge you to strengthen your faith while remaining vigilant." And the individual says, "But how, Rabbi?" And this line is so, he says, "Instead of focusing on the misuse of power, employ your vigilance to go deeper into yourself to find your true power." And I think that message, and that message then, that message now, and it's a timeless message. And so the contemplation, what is the power of love, and what is it to love moment to moment? And what is it to love in times that are dark? What is that love that he's summoning, that he embodied, that he called forth in extremely dark and painful conditions in those times?
Yeah, talk more about those conditions. I mean, you describe one of the characters is arrested for what was called the blood libel, the accusation that she killed a child in order to make the matzah for Passover. This was not an unusual thing. So talk about those terrible times that he existed in then.
Blood libel was one of many, one crucial accusation common against Jews, that the story told, or the threat or to Jews, was that it was said that when Passover approached, Jews needed the blood of Christian children to make their matzahs. And so this was, of course, fabricated. And what would happen is Jews were seized and tortured, and they were told that if they gave the names of other Jews, they would save their lives, or if they converted, they would save their lives. And not go into the gory details, there was tremendous torture involved, and there was great suffering, and some in their fear did name other Jews who, of course, hadn't done such a thing. And they, in the end, weren't saved either. So there are many stories. This is for centuries, not just in the 1700s, but that had gone on. So that was one thing. And of course, even within the Jewish community, hunger, suffering, there's always human suffering.
But you refer to a particular that in his time, just as you made the connection to, you know, in our time, I mean, there's always suffering, but there's sometimes that are scarier than others.
Yes, yes. Well, of course, as we said, one specter always was the blood libel, and just random reasons to attack the Jews, just random reasons to make them scapegoats. But also, the book takes place about 50 years after something cataclysmic in that area, and that they were called it, the pronouncing it is always tricky, but the Chelmnyeki massacres or uprisings, and there were some suffering and disenfranchised peasants who were led by Bogdan Chelmnyeki, and their targets really were the Polish noblemen, but they couldn't get to them. As I say in the book, they lived in fortresses and castles. And so they tried, but the Jews, as tax collectors and middle people, became the target. And so whole villages were massacred. Terrible things, forms of torture, massacre. Now, this isn't in the exact time of the book, but the specter of that time is very present in the book. And the influence of that despair, and then a false messiah that arose shortly after, and in the time of the book, another false messiah arises.
Yes, I wanted to ask you about that, because the history appears here as a great influence of a man who claimed that he was the messiah, Sabbatai Tzvi. I wonder if you could talk about false messiahs and true messiahs. Well, we can't really say the Baal Shem Tov was a messiah, but false leaders and true leaders, because it seems to me that that's another very resonant theme in this book. And we are talking with Ani Tusman. She is the author of a new novel based on the life of the Baal Shem Tov, and it is called The Tremble of Love.
Great point about false leaders and true leaders. So we just spoke about the false messiah Sabbatai Tzvi that arose on the heels of the Chelmnyeki uprisings. And one of the teachings, his teachings, and then subsequently Jacob Frank, who came to the fore in the 1700s, was that they drew on messianic teachings, and they said that in order for there to come an age of peace and redemption, there needed to be great chaos first. And so there was much of that in both of their teachings. One thing that also comes to mind in terms of the question of true and false leaders, and there's research now that's coming forth more that's come forth. Both of these individuals, there's reason to believe that there was mental illness. And in Sabbatai Tzvi, the words didn't exist, but manic depressive. He had episodes of immense depression and then exaltation. And what's amazing is how someone can take power or become a powerful figure who is so deeply flawed. So profoundly flawed. And so the question, I mean, there are answers in a sense in the novel, but of course any work of literature needs to also pose deep questions. And so one question one might say is that how is it that a flawed leader can gain a following? How is it that a flawed leader can assume power, great power? And in the end, can such a leader triumph? Or in the end, putting it somewhat simplistically, does love and truth triumph? And how are we then part of that? And that's part of what the book is examining, is reflecting. How are we in the face of the abuse of power? In this, by, for example, Jacob Frank, the leader that is said to be the reincarnation of Shabtai Tzvi, the Sabbatean leader in the 1600s. How is it that an individual responds in their life and as part of a community to the abuse of power? And also looking inside oneself for what is it, what was it, for example, back to the historical period of the book, what was it that drew people, this is a question that's looked at, to follow a leader like Shabtai Tzvi in the 1600s, and what calls people again to be drawn to a leader like Jacob Frank?
Or Donald Trump.
Yes, I'm not saying that, but yes. What is the desperation? What are the illusions? What is it? So that inner searching, and of course, some people who are follow might not do that inner searching, but it behooves all of us who can to look inside and try to fathom. I mean, one of the main teachings of the Baal Shem Tov was compassion. That's not pity. And he strongly says in many scenes in the book, that's not indifference, that's not passivity. But what does it mean for us now, for example, to be in this time period in touch with love and compassion that is not passivity, that is not sugarcoating, that is none of those things, but that is a dynamic force that I would say, and the Baal Shem Tov taught, is the greatest force, the greatest force.
And you, this is something you treat in this book, Ani Tusman, in this novel, The Tremble of Love, as the concept of devekut.
Yes, devekut, or dvekut, it's both ways.
You say it's a core concept of Jewish mystical tradition, and this is something we haven't really touched on yet, the role of mysticism, the Kabbalah. Tell us about devekut as a concept of Jewish mystical tradition, and explain to us what it is and how it is expressed in this novel.
So the word dvekut has as its root, it's often defined as cleaving, but it's not such a contemporary word. So in the book, I actually describe it as remembrance. So its definition, I think the root is even the word glue, or to glue oneself, or to connect oneself to the truth, to, again, in my author's note in the beginning of the book, I say something about the word God and people being able to use whatever word, whether it's from another religious tradition or no religious tradition at all, but to connect oneself, to remember, to root oneself in that, call it presence, call it being, call it God, call it Allah, call it Shekhinah. There's so many names for the one, for that remembrance, for that truth. So the concept of dvekut is to remember, is to, as I said, to root oneself. That image is a strong image throughout the book, the rooting in love, the rooting in remembrance. And that image is so powerful when the winds blow or the waves are intense and we lose our balance. And so dvekut is a practice, and some people call it the practice of presence, the practice of, I mean, can even in contemporary practice, the power of now, the power of being in the moment and remembering.
And it also have something to do with the connection we have with each other.
Well, yes, of course, because that when we are remembering, when we are connecting that way, what we're seeing that in each other, that's part of inherent in that process is we see that love in each other and we're connecting. If it's okay, it's funny, just before the call, sometimes I take the novel and I just open it. And I did that before the call. And someone is asking Yisroel about the abuse and some particularly powerful figures that are challenging Yisroel and demeaning him and threatening him. And he says, yes, I do see and have heard the accusations that concern you. And he says, goes on to say, my focus is the man or woman before me, her anguish, his pain, their beauty, their need and desire to be reminded of who they are. And when I read that passage again, I thought again of now, in our time, and many of us feeling powerless, many of us struggling not to be overtaken by fear or by anger. Not that those energies don't have a place, I'm not saying that, but here, what I just read is one of the possible responses, which is just what you just asked. How are we present with our neighbors? How are we present even with those with whom we disagree with? How are we present to each other's fears and pain and needs? And what does that mean in a moment-to-moment, day-to-day way? And that's much of what we see in the novel, in the Baal Shem Tov interacting.
Ani Tusman talking with us in 2018 about her novel, The Tremble of Love. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the rest of that interview and Tusman reading excerpts from the book. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.